You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the February 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of The Californians by Anna Peel. And this is the February cover story. With the gauzier parts of Meghan and Harry's tours, what Harry called the reasons to meet the people at the heart of our work, Louise says the question is, how are they helping anyone? And how is Archwell distinguishing itself from any other foundation? After raising more than $13 million in 2021, according to public disclosure forms, the charity grossed $2 million in 2022. The nonprofit has not yet shared its 2023 or 2024 revenue. Yes, it has them as spokespeople, Louis says, but they haven't had yet, because it's still quite new, a track record of being able to make philanthropic achievements independent of the palace. How complete that independence is another point that rankles people about Meghan and Harry. If you still use a title and descend upon Commonwealth or developing countries and let little girls curtsy to you, as one did to Meghan in Colombia, it doesn't seem like you've totally left the monarchy behind. It also doesn't give you a lot of room to critique it. The Netflix docuseries Harry and Meghan litigates in painstaking detail Harry's and Meghan's mental health declines, as she was bullied at the very least in sight of, and by many accounts, at the behest of, an imperialist establishment. Yet this doesn't seem to sour them to the idea of participating in a hereditary bloodline. In the doc, Harry says that during their last week as working senior royals, the couple, rueing the circumstances of their exit, kept telling each other, "We would have carried on doing this for the rest of our lives." When Charles ascended the throne after Elizabeth's death, the couple's children became Prince Archie and Princess Lilibet. Some people, familiar with the production of Archetypes and Harry's book tour, said they were instructed to address the couple as Sir or Ma'am, though the request was dropped in one instance after the person pushed back. Other people say they were encouraged by Harry and Meghan to call them by their first names. I think ultimately it's cachet and sets them apart as different and special, the source familiar with the couple says. In the U.S., success, money, fame, all of that stuff exists out here, but a blood title, it's few and far between. It's notable that what is understood to be Meghan's current inner circle, Kaling, Nacho Figueres' wife, socialite Delfina Blackier, Tracy Robbins, the fashion designer and wife of Paramount Global co-CEO Brian, parenting influencer and activist Kelly McKee Zafian, is basically living by the rules of American aristocracy, according to Louis. They stay behind the scenes, wield their power quietly, and look down on people who are very public, too thirsty. A Black Studies scholar, who is also an African-American woman, noted the way racism is discussed in Harry and Meghan, as the one-off actions of Princess Michael of Kent wearing a blackamoor brooch to a brunch where Meghan was present, or the distant colonialism that still furnishes the duchies of Cornwall and Lancaster and the jewels in the family's tiaras, or Harry saying that the royal family merely had unconscious bias. It's a very common discursive move, the scholar says, locating racism in individual bad actors or locating it in the past. Queen Elizabeth becomes a kindly grandmother. She's in the back of a car or her carriage under a blanket. There's that story, which is really kind of sweet, that Megan tells in the documentary. But it can't connect that with the larger ideology of England, and thereby Queen Elizabeth being like, we are the natural rulers of the world, and that includes the segregation of people of color. The cultural critic says this framing makes it so Meghan and Harry can tell the story of being victims of the system, but it's all about them being disenfranchised from whiteness and white privilege. The couple repeatedly expressed frustration in Harry and Meghan that Meghan wasn't tapped as an asset for upholding the crown's international interest in an era when Prince William was tasked with expressing profound sorrow for the appalling atrocity of slavery during a tour to Jamaica. As historian David Olusoga says in the docuseries, part of what makes the inability of the palace to defend Meghan an even bigger disaster is that the center of the argument for the monarchy in this country is the Commonwealth. The Commonwealth is 2.5 billion, mainly black and brown people. Here was a woman who looked like most of the people in the Commonwealth. Harry speaks shortly after and says the palace and its denizens have already missed an enormous opportunity with my wife and how far that would go globally. The source familiar with the couple says it's important to note that Harry isn't an anti-monarchist. He just didn't like the way things were run within the institution, he says. His issues are about people and behaviors, not tradition. The source, who is also a person of color, defends Meghan's right to want a piece of the empire for herself. If I was in the same position and I was treated the way I was by the institution, it wouldn't stop me from still feeling that that title is mine and deserved, they say. If anything, it would feel like you're giving in to the pressure to exclude you in the first place. So actually, it would probably make me want it even more. Damn well I'm going to slap it on my kids' names, too. Natalie Portman, Jeff Bridges, John Carradine, Kirk and Michael Douglas, Jonathan Winters, Gwyneth Paltrow, Adam Levine, Jimmy Connors, T.C. Boyle, Leonardo DiCaprio, Neil Young, and Daryl Hannah, Michael Keaton, and of course Oprah, are among the many celebrities who have peacefully coexisted with other locals in Montecito, an unincorporated part of Santa Barbara County. When a Montecitan's Labradoodle ran up to a child and licked their ice cream, the kid's father, Kardashian affiliate Scott Disick, ran up to the pet owner with concern, not because he was upset that the cone was ruined, but to reassure the person that the ice cream was vegan and wouldn't upset the dog's stomach. Katy Perry has, per usual, had some legal real estate issues, and Ellen DeGeneres has become unpopular for her immaculate, usually off-market flips that have supposedly driven house prices up. I think everyone, including the A-list celebs, would prefer that it's not on the map like it is, the Montecitan says. It's a place where no one would ever bother a famous person beyond saying hello at the coffee shop, as they would to anyone else. One resident says Montecito's defining characteristics are quiet and neighborliness. The prince and the starlet, as the Montecitan calls her, have become local villains, according to several people who spoke with Vanity Fair. They attribute the increase in housing prices to them as much as to DeGeneres and point to out-of-towners coming in, driving too fast, and taking up all the street parking by local trails, like the one Meghan was photographed hiking on while Harry was in the UK for Charles's coronation. You can't just walk into Lucky's for dinner anymore. While the Montecitan says neither he nor his friends have ever met the couple, two others mentioned Harry biking in town, they popped up in the video for DeGeneres and Portia de Rossi's vow renewal, and the Montecitan saw photos of Harry playing polo at a nearby field, which will also be featured in Harry's Netflix docuseries. Meghan's Netflix project was filmed at a house near theirs. American Riviera Orchard which on Instagram has a logo styled with a royal-looking crest. That's American Riviera Orchard. And written in Megan's perfect calligraphy and is known internally as ARO, is located in Montecito. Though an 1898 book published by the Southern Pacific Company Rail Line states, the Montecito is known as the American Riviera. Today, that honor is understood to belong to Santa Barbara. No one Vanity Fair spoke with had ever heard Montecito referred to by the name. It's such a kind of hucksterism, one resident says. It's just finding every way she can to monetize something, and in doing so, bringing more attention to the place where the Sussexes say they want to be left alone. I still think they're the most entitled, disingenuous people on the planet, the Montecitan says. They moved away from England to get away from the scrutiny of the press, and all they do is try and get in the press in the United States. Louise says the most common criticism she hears about Meghan, though she notes it's true of Harry as well, is you can't cherry-pick the good parts and leave out the bad parts of fame. However, she points out, all celebrities do this. Don't take photos of me. Oh, but here, let me step out conveniently and get papped. Only give me good reviews of my movie or my album, and if you don't like my music, I'm going to post on Instagram that you're so shitty as a reviewer. Whether American Riviera Orchard will be well-received, or received at all, at least in name, remains to be seen. On August 31st, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office rejected the trademark application. Registration is refused because the applied-for mark is primarily geographically descriptive, the response read. In other words, you can't claim a place. Tell that to Queen Victoria. The same day, according to the New York Post, the office reportedly received a complaint from storied pair purveyor Harry and David regarding the similarity in name to its Royal Riviera line. As far as the substance of the brand, Louise says Meghan's first lifestyle effort, the TIG, was popular in Louise's circle in Toronto while Meghan was filming Suits there. However, American Riviera Orchard, to me, is giving 2014. It's not giving 2024, she says. Fame arrests you at the moment it arrives, and I wonder if that is your health and wellness lifestyle version of that, where she had to suspend the TIG and quit it the moment that she became Harry's girlfriend, then fiancé, and then his wife. American Riviera Orchard is maybe picking up from where the TIG left off. The source familiar with the couple says, I think there's one thing that no one could take away from Meghan is how hard she works, how much effort goes into everything that she does. Ultimately, that's all she needs. And I think that's why American Riviera Orchard probably will be a massive success. Even if in 2 years' time it doesn't exist anymore and she's on to the next, it will have that moment. There will be no way that you can say that it wasn't successful. A few years ago, a rumor began circulating around the book world about another prospective project for Meghan. This story, which a person with knowledge confirms the broad details of, was that Meghan's team had a conversation with a publishing house to gauge interest in the idea for a potential book. The concept, for which there was no written or formal proposal, was post-divorce. Not a general book on life after marital dissolution, or one about Meghan's past experience. She was married to producer Trevor Engelson from 2011 to 2014. This book, this notion of a book really, might center on a post-Harry divorce. Not that there was actually one in the works. Just if this a priori divorce ever came to be, would this publisher theoretically be interested in a book that took place in its aftermath? Another source with knowledge says if that's true to any degree, she would have been approached and not vice versa. No offer was ever made and no manuscript was produced. After all, there was no divorce. The source familiar with the couple says Megan's metabolism for campaigns that she can move on from, archetypes, the ephemeral 40 by 40 mentorship program, the forthcoming lifestyle line and show, the wisp of a possible book about a divorce that might never happen, are part of why she's better suited to celebrity outside the palace. The royals don't work like that, the source says. How many years has Kate been talking about early childhood development, like 11, now 12? We still haven't seen anything, really. Princess Catherine launched Shaping Up, a campaign focused on increasing public understanding of the crucial importance of the first 5 years of a child's life. In that time, Meghan has gone from star of a syndicated cable series to paradigm-changing princess, to her husband's conduit out of royal life, to the founder of a hybrid charity Hollywood startup. She has earned as much faith in her own force of will as a sovereign might have from believing that they were anointed by God to lead. As for what she'll do with that power, look at what it means for her to make the world a better place, which she and Harry genuinely seem to want to do. Jamila Jamil, Chrissy Teigen, and Omid Scobie, the author of Finding Freedom, about Harry and Meghan's time in and departure from royal life, and Endgame, about the ensuing years within the Windsor dynasty, have all publicly discussed Meghan unexpectedly reaching out during difficult times in their lives and offering solace, even though they weren't close. Louise sees it as something Meghan took from her royal years, just as Harry has taken his impeccable manners and the ability to patronize the F out of a charity. That's what they do, Louis says. They bless you with their royalness, and that's the gift. It's not like Princess Diana was ever best friends with all the people that she visited in the hospital. I think that they don't know what change the world means, says the person who worked in media projects. They want to be people who are looked at as people who want to change the world. Maybe that's why Meghan has continued on Nick News, in The Tig, on Panels, on Archetypes, in Colombia, in August, to bring up the story of writing a letter to Procter & Gamble about a sexist soap ad, taking credit for them changing the spot so that it no longer suggested women should be the ones doing dishes. Procter & Gamble declined many requests from Vanity Fair to confirm that Meghan was the impetus for the switch, and in 2021, the company partnered with Archwell with the goal of elevating the voices of adolescent girls to ensure their point of view and lived experience is heard at the tables where decisions are made. Whether or not Meghan's letter is what prompted the change, the fact that more than 30 years later she continues to speak up about having spoken up suggests it's the kind of mission she aspires to. Marie, who has worked with many celebrities, says of the Sussexes' aspirations, "I think it's actually better than where most people start out." To point out the modesty of that world bettering feels like contributing to the essential problem of Harry and Meghan. No matter what they do, they just can't win. If, I guess, you don't count the overwhelming portion of their beautiful lives that exist outside of Daily Mail headlines and blog comment sections. If Harry's burden is the soft oppression of no expectations, Meghan's might be the opposite, the betrayal of not living up to an unachievable ideal. I think the whole world was waiting for her to be that person, and then she never jumped, the source who worked in media says. Diana walked amongst landmines. Meghan couldn't even say the word slut. Girls Interrupted by Evgenia Peretz. Nestled in the Berkshires, with a pedigree dating back to 1898, Miss Hall's school appears to be a cocoon of safety and formative tutelage for its students, all of them young women. But for decades, an alleged sexual predator operated on campus. Now alumnae are speaking out in hopes of holding their former teacher and the school accountable. Opening photograph by Mark Seliger. Hillary Simon and Melissa Fairs, photographed in Far Rockaway, New York, November 2024. Next photo, Simon with Matt Rutledge at her 2005 graduation. Matt Rutledge was watching television with Annie, his wife of 35 years, when the bombshell phone call came in. On the other end was Julia Heaton, the head of school at Miss Hall's, the small all-girls boarding school across the street in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, where for three decades, since 1991, Rutledge had been the star history teacher and a charismatic face of the school. Heaton had bad news to share. The school had received a letter accusing Rutledge of sexual misconduct with a former student. Frantic, he texted Hillary Simon, his former student and advisee. "If this is related to you and me," he wrote, "I am so sorry. I am not sure how to conduct myself here, other than knowing that I can only offer a blanket denial and decline the opportunity to say more than that to anyone who asks to speak to me. I'm shaking as I type this, because I'm terrified, of course, but I don't really know what else to do." As she read it, Simon was shaking. She thought she'd die with their secret, that when he was 40 and she was 15, he'd sought her out and eventually began a sexual relationship that lasted well into her 20s. He cajoled her, obsessed over her. She was sure she was the only one. By the end of their conversation, in spite of herself, she found herself promising to gather what information she could to try to help him. A problem like Rutledge was the kind of thing that elite educational institutions swept under the rug in the 1980s and 90s. But by the 2010s, private schools across the country had begun reckoning with instances of sexual abuse by faculty members. Astonishingly, Miss Halls seems to have made the gamble to keep silent, even as the world around it changed. The school declined to respond to Vanity Fair's questions, pending an ongoing investigation. Now, stories about Rutledge are flooding out from a group of brave women going back decades, and they all bear striking similarities in their specific patterns. Their stories are similar in another way, too, in that they center on the most vulnerable part of girlhood and of growing up, the time when a person's beliefs and identity are taking shape. And if that vulnerability is pierced, it can shatter a life forever. "I still struggle with feelings of shame and self-disgust. That's a big one lately," says Melissa Fairs, who until the past boiled up and sent her life sideways, was a reporter at Reuters. "We were in the kitchen of her childhood home in Wilton, Connecticut, where Rutledge once read to her from Pooh and Friends on the floor as she, then 16, fell asleep on his shoulder. She's warm and down to earth, wearing shorts and a tie-dyed sweatshirt. Wine is on hand if needed, she tells me." Her sharp, spirited, and slightly nervous mother, Christina, bustles in and out from her cigarette breaks on the hammock overlooking her gardens. She fixes drinks and sandwiches, then stops in her tracks and ask whether Melissa really wants her there. Melissa assures her that she does. Rutledge got his hooks into Christina, too, much to her embarrassment. And at this point, there's no detail her mother can't hear, though at one time, Fairs, like Hillary Simon, thought she'd die with her secret, too. "I feel disgusted, obviously, mostly by him," says Fairs. "But there's part of me that feels like he injected his shame into me, that's just lasted for so many years," she says. "He was inside of me physically, but literally infiltrated my life, my family's life, my mom's life, my dad's life, my brother, everybody. In 2006, Fares was 14 and felt lost in the crowd at the public school she was attending. She told her parents that she wanted more academic attention and became fixated on going to boarding school. Her strict father, Nabil, an emigre from Lebanon, was reluctant but agreed under the condition that it be an all-girl school. After the family visited a few, one rose to the top, Miss Halls. The idyllic Berkshire Jewel, with fewer than 200 students in the student body, and a price tag of up to $72,000 for a year of tuition, had an attractive pedigree. Founded in 1898, it was the first all-girls boarding school in Massachusetts. Like Miss Porter's, Emma Willard, and other historic all-girls schools that dot New England, it promised, still promises, women's empowerment in a testosterone-free environment. Virginie Norris, then the head of school, touted a specific brand of women's leadership, rooted in what one alumna calls respectability politics. Being ladylike was important. Gossiping about one's elders was sacrilege. Issues around sex and sexuality were circumscribed. For any parent hoping for a safe cosseting environment, this one seemed to fit the bill. On their visit, the Fairses were invited to sit in on the American history class of Matt Rutledge, who had knocked their socks off with his charisma. The Fairses were sold. Miss Halls wasn't the easy transition Fairs had hoped for. Coming in as a sophomore, she found it hard to make friends. Rutledge, her history teacher, immediately identified that loneliness. He acknowledged how tough it must be for her. Focusing on her work would help her, he said. He promised he could make me a better writer, which was huge for me, Fair says now. His attention was a jolt. She'd been aware of his special status at the school since the day the Fairses had toured. He was a family man. He made sure people knew. A photo of his wife and kids hung outside his classroom, and his two daughters attended the school. Tall and imposing, he played a lot of hockey in the local league in Northampton. He had a cultured side, too. He wrote poetry, and in the summers he was the director of the Tanglewood Music Center's residential program at Miss Hall's. Boldly inhabiting his Renaissance man persona, he was known to start his first class of the year with, "I'm Matt Rutledge, as you know. I'm smart, funny, charming, handsome, and modest," to a chorus of awkward girlish titters. He strutted the halls, rattling off inside jokes to any student who might pass, sometimes calling out, "Make way for Mr. Wonderful." The comically over-the-top bluster was part of the charm. Or so it seemed to Fairs. Others, including many of the teachers, had a hunch that his arrogance was compensating for insecurity. "He had a shit childhood," says a former teacher who knew him well, pointing to parents who divorced when he was young and an absent father. His academic bona fides weren't especially sparkly. Berkshire Community College and University of Massachusetts Amherst. He started a Ph.D. program at UMass, writing about the Gilded Age mansions of the Berkshires, but didn't complete it. He'd harbored dreams of being a writer, but they never panned out. "He was a big fish in a small pond," says another former faculty member. "That's how we thought of him, as kind of pathetic and insecure. He was only strong within those walls." Next photos, Rutledge and Simon with her cross-country teammates. Rutledge and Fairs in Wilton, Connecticut, in the summer of 2008. To Fairs, Rutledge was the big man on campus, bar none. She began going to his study halls in his classroom, where she says they'd usually be alone. On such evenings, he'd outfit his room with debonair touches, snacks like dried cherries, raw almonds, and fancy dark chocolate from Canada, where he had a cabin. He'd have cool music playing, Stevie Ray Vaughan, The Police, Van Morrison. He'd encourage her to take a nap if she was sleepy. He thrilled in the size differential, it seemed. I don't want to say twice my height, but he towered above me, says Fares, who is 5'4". He began to call her little one and would comment, for instance, such a big sigh for such a little girl. Rutledge did not respond to detailed questions from Vanity Fair. As their sessions continued, his conversations became more daring. "You're my type," he told her one evening. "Dark hair, dark eyes, like Penelope Cruz or Salma Hayek." "Penelope Cruz," she remembers thinking. "I'll take it." He'd share stories about his own youth, blighted by drugs and bad characters, and the sad state of his marriage. He and his wife hadn't had sex for ages. Then he'd drop in a question about her boyfriend back home. He asked if he had performed oral sex on me, she recalls. He'd put his legs up on the table and encourage her to rest her legs on his. He began giving her mixtapes with songs like Sweet Thing by Van Morrison, Fields of Gold by Sting, Let's Give 'Em Something to Talk About by Bonnie Raitt. Pulse racing, she'd study the lyrics for signs of his desire. On Friday night school trips to the Berkshire Mall, he drove the van and had her sit beside him with the other girls in the back. He'd have one hand on the wheel and the other on her thigh. "I'm thinking, this man has lost his mind," Fierce recalls. "He must be obsessed with me. He can't resist me. He's taking these chances." Even with the heady emotional rush, Fares' loneliness hadn't subsided, and she was having doubts about returning the following year, which posed a problem for Norris. The board had hired Norris in 1996, when the school was in dire financial straits, and student retention was a serious problem. Norris, polished and formal, was remarkably successful in turning things around, raising $55 million in capital campaigns over what would ultimately be 16 years at the helm, for example. And she was determined not to let the school backslide. In the spring of 2008, Norris met with Fares' parents to discuss her happiness. As Christina Fares recalls, Norris asked if there were any teachers with whom Melissa was particularly close who might encourage her to stay on. "Matt Rutledge," Christina replied. She and Nabil had gotten to know him themselves. They'd even gone out to dinner with him on their visits to see their daughter. He'd been so helpful with her writing. "Then it was settled," Norris advised. "You two don't press," she suggested to the parents. "Let Rutledge take the lead." Norris did not respond to questions from Vanity Fair. That summer, the Fairs family invited him to visit their house in Wilton. Melissa sat by the guest cottage where he was to stay, anxiously awaiting his arrival. Rutledge came bearing gifts, a sun hat for Christina, an avid gardener, a book by the erudite British author Simon Winchester for Nabil, Pooh and Friends for Melissa. Melissa had her own gift to impart, a leather-bound scrapbook she'd made featuring images of cows. An inside joke, as he had a thing for cows and would mutter moo when Melissa said something he liked. When she gave it to him, tears formed in his eyes. The scrapbook was a sign that she'd be back in the fall. The next morning they went for a walk, and he took her hand as they strolled. When they got to a secluded dead end, he gave her a lingering embrace, so long that she braced excitedly for a kiss. He held off for now. For the rest of the weekend, he gardened with Christina, played guitar with Melissa's brother, Emil, and talked college prospects with Nabil. Rutledge and the family enjoyed a hot tub together. They all went out for a sushi dinner, and he placed a hand on Melissa's leg under the table, a thrilling act of illicitness that promised more to come. "You stuffed me to perfection," he wrote in his 4-page thank you letter to the family. Upon Fares' return, her junior fall, Rutledge became her advisor, signing off on her comings and goings and steering all of her relationships. He eagerly encouraged a new friendship with his younger daughter, who was a grade below and played defense with her on varsity soccer. As the two girls grew closer, he naturally saw more of Fares. One day that fall, he took the girls to Great Barrington for ice cream. They found a creek bank to enjoy it on, and Rutledge's daughter sat in front of them. Fair sat near his casually splayed out legs. Then right behind his daughter's back, literally, he kissed Fair's for the first time. I was shocked, because I just went with it, because what else am I going to do, she says, perhaps voicing exactly his calculus. Whatever Fair's fears, they were eclipsed by her sense of intoxication. There's something about me that he loves, and it makes you feel like you're walking on water, she recalls. They were each other's protectors, he insisted, and the stakes couldn't be higher. If you ever tell anyone, I will kill myself, he told her. He was quick to cover their tracks, instructing her how to delete instant messages. But Fares didn't realize that their relationship was becoming evident to others. Her schoolmate Bethany Fusini, now Bethany Whitney, class of 11, recalls the sight of them pulling up in the van together, side by side, with his daughter in the back. It just felt like he was with his girlfriend, Whitney says. During the same period, he began corresponding with Fares' mother in long emails. He wove together guileless-sounding personal anecdotes about, say, Easter egg hunts gone awry, snippets intended to show his propriety. Melissa's birthday is coming up. I'd like to give her a couple of little things. Please let me know if you would prefer I didn't, okay? And read in a certain light, romanticish phrasing. My dear Christina, I'm glad to make you smile, of course. It makes me happy to do so. Hugs and kisses. He sent her his poetry, which he hoped the New Yorker would publish, a young birch tree to plant, and a Stevie Ray Vaughan CD collection. I was a sucker, admits Christina. I fell right into it. I was in the right frame of mind to welcome the attention of an attractive man who, P.S., was actually helping my daughter. He was still working on Melissa, too. One fall morning at dawn, his favorite time of day, he told her, she showed up at his classroom as instructed, wearing her pajamas. He met her at the doorway, locked the door behind her, pulled down the shade. He told her to get under a classroom desk, took off her pajamas, and performed oral sex on her for the first time. A few months later, just after she had turned 17, the instructions got more elaborate. Come in your pajamas, but first go to the laundry room, located next to the classroom, and put in a load of laundry. A plausible excuse. This time, he brought her to the closet, where he'd laid down a yoga mat, and he raped her. That's not what she called it at the time, but it was the first time she felt a sense of having been violated. People ask me, well, was it consensual? And I'm like, how do you give consent at that age, in that context? He's a big guy and was just forceful. So I didn't say anything, and he came inside me. She bled, and she panicked. She wasn't on birth control. He assured her that he'd had a vasectomy, a term she'd never heard before. But if she wanted to have a baby with him, it could be reversed, he said. She went back to her dorm, googled vasectomy, and breathed a sigh of relief. Next photos, Fares, Rutledge, and Fares' mother during a family trip to Wilton, and the grounds of Miss Hall's school. As junior year turned to senior year, the sex became frequent, and he introduced her to alcohol, bottom-shelf Evan Williams whiskey, encouraging her to take shots and imagine she was tasting the woods. He'd have sex with her in his guest room while his wife and daughters were sleeping. Rutledge again visited the Fares family in Wilton, this time with his daughter. Fares and the daughter shared Fares' bedroom, but Fares sneaked into the cottage, which he had dubbed the Rutledge Cottage, to have sex with him. In 2010, when Fares was 18 and ready for college, she chose Smith in Northampton, in part to stay close to him. The relationship took a darker turn still. He'd steal away from Pittsfield on a Sunday, telling his family he was going to hockey practice. He'd show up at her dorm with cases of wine. This was the beginning, she says, of her dependency on alcohol, something she would struggle with for years. He'd take her to the North King Motel, where he paid in cash. On occasion, he'd give her baby doll-style nighties. As she'd perform oral sex on him, he would film her from his laptop. "This is all I have to remember you by," he'd tell her. He assured her the files were encrypted. Other nights, the action happened in his car. And she gives a description and apologizes for it being graphic. "Drive me around, go to the hospital parking lot, give me a shot of whiskey, and make him orgasm, and then drop me back off." The thrill had turned into hollow degradation. She thought about telling friends, but the threat of him taking his own life continued to loom. She became increasingly isolated, routinely lying to her friends about her whereabouts. On nights when other girls were out socializing with one another, she often stayed in her room, alone, drinking the bottles of wine he'd brought her. By the time Fares reached her 20s, she tried to break his hold and see other men. But Rutledge did what he could to stop her. He gave her a vibrator and told her she didn't need to explore other relationships. "Just use it and think of him." She moved to New York in 2014 to attend Columbia Journalism School, where she met a man she started dating. Rutledge created a fake Instagram account to follow her and saw a picture of them together. She recalls one night when she was in a taxi going to meet the new boyfriend. "He called me, and he was screaming and crying. He was so hysterical," she says, "completely unhinged. How could you do this to me?" Fares, now 32, finally saw his monstrousness and repellence. But the damage felt irrevocable. She struggled in one relationship after another, often freezing during sex or dissociating. For a time, she could only perform the act while intoxicated. As she bluntly puts it, "I always say, or have said to people recently, I don't know how to make love, I know how to F." At her fifth Miss Hall's reunion, she had sex with him for the last time at his mother's house. "I just felt so little of myself." As Fares eventually entered therapy, some truths about herself and her experience began to crystallize. "Why am I so good at lying? Well, he was so good at lying. Why do I feel so much shame? Well, the shame I feel is also his shame. And that's what predators, I think, do. They take their shame, they put it on you, and you have to carry it." One day in 2019, her story came tumbling out to her mother and then to her brother. Nabil, who died in 2021, had developed dementia, which spared Fares from having to tell him. Christina was heartbroken for her daughter, crushed with guilt for not seeing what was in front of her. She supported her in how she wanted to proceed with her story. Melissa knew coming out publicly would hurt Rutledge's daughter, with whom she had remained friends, and so she held back. But last March, she felt the need to speak up despite that friendship. "I felt like I had forgiven myself enough to be able to come forward and speak from a place of, not authority, but some profound experience that this was not my fault and this needs to be discussed. This man needs to not be able to teach ever again." Through a lawyer, Fair sent a letter to the current head of school, Julia Heaton, who began in 2014 and told her the headlines of her story. At the same time, she reached out to a woman she didn't know, but whose name she had heard, Hillary Simon, née Casper, class of 05. While Fares was at Miss Hall's, she'd heard whispers that he'd had a relationship with Simon when Simon attended the school 5 years earlier. Fares recalls Googling her back then. Simon was petite, with dark hair, dark eyes, just like her. At the time, Fares asked Rutledge about her, but he denied any involvement. He loved only her, he insisted, and this was his first time doing anything of the kind. Fares accepted it, but doubt nagged at her. Now, 15 years later, Fares decided to put out feelers to the woman. Maybe she'd had an experience similar to her own. That is where this story began. On the same morning that Simon received the frantic text from Rutledge, she went into her office, an insurance law firm in New York, and stared at the email from the lawyer representing Melissa Fairs, a name she'd never heard of, asking to talk. She felt like she might throw up. It was now clear to her that Fairs was the woman behind the complaint to the school. Her first reaction was jealousy, even though Simon was now married with a 3-year-old child. She promptly called Rutledge and unloaded. Who is Melissa Fairs? Rutledge tap-danced on the phone, claiming Fairs had been just the result of a midlife crisis and his unhappy marriage. And then Simon went into protection mode, as she had so many times before. She promised to collect information from Fairs and report back. Simon, now 37, called Fairs, but just moments into their conversation, hearing the voice of the young woman on the other end of the line, a switch went off, says Simon. She found herself saying, "I've been waiting for this call for 20 years. As she listened to Fairs' story, a wave of sorrow fell over her. "I just remember feeling so sad that I didn't protect her, that I didn't stop him." Simon shared her story back. For both women, the sense of specialness they both once felt was peeled away. Their stories were twin accounts, 5 years apart and overlapping, marked by the same plot points and scenes. But there was a new angle to Simon's story, evidence that the school knew the truth about Rutledge and did nothing to stop him. Much like Fairs, Simon is warm and intelligent, with a hint of grief behind a pretty face. Notes and photos of her with Rutledge sit in tidy piles on her dining room table. In them, she's baby-faced, eyes twinkling, barely up to his shoulder. Looking at one, she says that she's telling her story, at least in part, for that girl whose future he stole. Like Fairs, 14-year-old Simon found it hard to make friends when she arrived at Miss Hall's in 2001. She was dealing with a family member's mental health issues that required all her parents' attention. "I was still reeling from a childhood of chaos and violence," she says. That first year, Rutledge, the faculty member on check-in duty at the dorm, always made a special effort to talk to her from the doorway as she settled into bed, which she found comforting. As with Fairs, when she wavered on whether to return the following year, he successfully persuaded her to do so. He became her advisor and cross-country coach that year. In that capacity, he orchestrated one-on-one runs together, taking her to State Forest, Kennedy Park, and October Mountain. As he did with Fairs, he fetishized her smallness. He'd been down to tie her running shoe and called her Little One. It was here, on these secluded paths, that he began sharing personal stories of his troubled youth, just as he would do with Fairs, and opening up about his unsatisfying marriage. She recalls admissions director Kim Boland giving her a peculiar admonishment when she drove off campus with him in the van. "Be a good girl for Mr. Rutledge." Boland did not respond to questions sent to Miss Hall's school. Then came the touching, in his one-on-one study halls, where he'd play music and have her drape her legs over his, in the front seat of the van, where he'd have a hand on her thigh while other girls were in back. There were the mixtapes, the IMs and letters, which said things like, "I feel like a drowning man, I want to breathe you in." "Cherish them," he told her, "but delete or shred immediately." There was the same charming of her parents with gifts and gushing prose about their daughter, as if daring to hint at their secret. Her daughter, he told them in a typical report card, was the whole package. Their daily runs, he wrote, helped him out of his blue funk. There was the same thrill he got by mingling with them and taking risk behind their backs. He took Simon and her parents to Tanglewood, where Rutledge kissed her in a wooded area. Two small children happened to be running by, and they stopped to look. Simon tried to push him away, but he pulled her closer. "I want them to watch us. They need to learn." There was the same urgent promise to keep quiet, that if she ever told anyone, he'd kill himself. As with Fairs, He just created a perfect scenario to isolate me and possess me, she says. I felt like all I needed was him. Despite her isolation, the relationship was evident to many, as it would be with Fares. He was always with Hillary, in the book locker room or the hallway, says Joe Zuber, class of 07. People would talk about Hillary having an affair with Mr. Rutledge. In the fall of Simon's senior year, her friend Allison Gluick walked in on her and Rutledge in one of his study halls to find them cuddled together, his hands up Simon's shirt. Simon ran out of the room, but Gluick remained and laid into him. I'm going to report you, Gluick recalls telling Rutledge. I saw what you did. I'm going to tell the police. Rutledge went at her, telling her that he'd ruin both her and Simon's chances of getting into college. Nobody's going to believe you, and Hillary won't say a word. Gluick broke down in tears and left. Walking through the campus, the sobbing girl was spotted by the college counselor, Sarah Verdon, an outsized force at the school who'd been there since the 90s and whose lifeblood was girl drama. According to several alumni, Verdon often had certain girls over at her apartment adjoining the dorm to watch TV and hang out in the evenings. Gluick told her what she'd just seen. Verdon asked no further questions and curtly replied, "You should be in your room." Verdon did not respond to requests for comment. Several months later, on Simon's graduation day, a similar incident occurred. Another classmate walked into a classroom and saw Simon and Rutledge kissing. Simon says she had been crying about leaving him, and he had just told her he loved her. The classmate reported the kiss to the dean of students. According to Simon, who later learned about the turn of events, this time word got up to the assistant head of school, Jenny Chandler, as well as Norris, who called him in. Rutledge denied it, and they accepted it. He promptly told Simon that he would commit suicide that day if she admitted to it. But no one from Miss Hall's ever followed up with Simon or notified her parents. Chandler could not be reached for comment. Rutledge, then 43, first had sex with Simon on a mattress laid out on the floor of the New York City apartment of his best friend Joshua Green, editor of Wine and Spirits magazine. She was 17, still a virgin, and had just graduated. Green did not respond to request for comment. The promise of romance turned dark. As with Fares, it was animalistic and forceful. As with Fares, after he finished, he told her not to worry, that he'd had a vasectomy, but it could be reversed if she ever wanted to have a child with him. After the act, she recalls lying in a fetal position, distressed and confused, against the cold tile of the bathroom floor. That set in motion a hellish next several years of dark hotel rooms, the bedroom of his school-owned home, his car tarps that he would put out in the woods. Back to Josh's apartment, my childhood bedroom, college dorm rooms, says Simon. As with Fares, he'd take Simon to the North King Motel, where he dressed her in the same childlike 90s, read to her from Where the Wild Things Are while she lay on his naked body, and filmed her while she gave him oral sex, something to remember her by. As Simon moved into her 20s, around the time he was first beginning to groom Fares, a tragic kind of clarity came over her one day. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. interval selection by Mark Hoffman.